next 2 hours tonight, we're going to hear from some people who are doing some extraordinary work in the desert plateaus of Arizona. We're going to be bringing you parts of an interview that we conducted about 2 weeks ago with Paolo Soleri, who is the world's first arcologist. Arcology is a word that Paolo Soleri invented. It's a contraction of architecture and ecology. And Soleri is probably the first major architecture figure of this century to have really absorbed the ecological perspective. And the amazing thing is that he did it about 30 years ago. We're also going to be bringing you an interview with one of his students, a young man by the name of Jack Blackwell, who has a lot of very amazing things to say. Soleri has, over the course of the years of his labors, transformed himself from being a simple designer to a creator of enormous and revolutionary schemes for new types of cities. For years he was rather misunderstood and thought to be very far out and revolutionary. And it's only lately that the basic conservatism of his approach has come to be understood. Conservative in the sense that Soleri, who was born in Italy, educated in Europe and the United States, has inherited the best of the classical European traditions of urbanism and the intellectual life. When he came to the United States, he became a student of Frank Lloyd Wright and studied with Wright at his winter desert retreat outside of Phoenix, Arizona. At the time, this was in the 40s, Taliesin West was very isolated on the outskirts of Phoenix, and Soleri bought some land nearby in the wide open spaces of the expanding perimeters of the Phoenix suburbs. And with his wife Kali, he created the Cosanti Foundation. Cosanti's is an Italian word meaning before things, or some people translate it against things. And the work of the Cosanti Foundation has grown and proliferated tremendously over the years. Soleri has published his work widely in a series of fantastic drawings and notebooks. And perhaps this is the wrong medium to share that kind of information with you, but at the same time, Soleri has turned his considerable intellect onto trying to understand the needs of the city and the development of appropriate habitats for human beings to grow in and to preserve the best values of civilization, the things that he responds to.
There's a factor of a great power within the universe, which is not space, nor time, nor mass energy. It's complexity, which resolves itself into consciousness and self-consciousness and intelligence and so on. And this factor is, for the moment, as far as we know, might be isolated in few spots, or maybe a few billions of spots, who knows, but still quite isolated. those are phenomena which are isolated from each other, but they are phenomena that eventually, if they develop enough power, will coalesce into a one event. And this complexity has its own form of infinity or immensity or power. And we are beginning now to see what that power might be or could be through our action on this solar system. Since it's a power which is still used by a very primitive or a very young phenomenon, it's used, is misused, and it's made into actions which are very often detrimental to the whole balance. But it is a power. The conscience of the human family seems to be one of the new factors within the universe that might eventually transform this universe totally. And I take that as a hint or as a guideline, and I introduce the idea of the urban effect as the device, as the procedure by which this new power in the universe might be able to cause a transcendence of matter into spirit.
One of the ways that Solari has supported his activities over the year has been by teaching. Literally thousands of students have passed through the Kasanti Foundation in Scottsdale, and now through Arkasanti, the new city, town, actually, the first arcology, Solari's demonstration project of his ideas for integrated town design. Many of the students who've come to live and work at the foundation have wanted to make a hero out of Solari. And when Will Nofke and I spoke with him, we asked him about that. All of the I've seen the relationship that you have to your students described by the word mastership. And Jack has just essentially alluded to the same thing, that everyone considers you to be an evolved being who has been able to... I can't get past your sense of humor in saying that.
Oh, that twinkle coming over his knuckles.
I think you understand what I'm trying to say, though.
Yes.
The people have gathered around you in order to look at what you've done with your life. They're willing to confer upon you some authority in the sense of wanting to learn from you. And how do you participate in that process with them?
Well, I believe in leadership, but with a great reservation, which is that we should understand that no matter how good the leader is, he's still fumbling and, you know, seeking and probing and falling flat on his face, on her face, and so on. So we should be very clear about that, which brings me to the, not to a parallel, but to a cautionary saying or advice. Watch out about the guru and the instant wisdom and paradise tomorrow and all those things. So we are trying, at least personally I'm trying to be very clear, and maybe I'm not very clear, about the fact that we wish not so much to become a privileged or a perfect or utopian group, but we would like to be very much normal in almost any way, but possibly with some understanding of what normality could be. So
you
I have
a rather high.
I have a long list of yes
vision
and no's.
Of normality, right?
Yeah, but in many ways, I feel that what I'm attempting to convey is normality, as against something very abnormal which is happening now, and this abnormality is expressed quite well, too well, by many of the things that we as a technologian, as a technological being, are doing and developing. So I see that what I'm trying to bring back really is a sense of normality which has been lost. So I sometimes make the parallel between a bricklayer that using the same old kind of rectangular brick as someone else that wants to be original, so he's going to make spherical bricks and then tries to build with spherical bricks. And I would say, well, the Los Angelinos, as an idea, are the ones that are trying to use round bricks. I stick with the square bricks because I feel that I'm trying to make just a little tiny step within the evolutionary process, as I see it.
Well, you have been described as a spokesman for some fairly traditional, in the best sense, ideas, or some conservative mm-hmm. ways of looking at human culture. But in the sense that associating with you essentially transforms whoever is doing that personally,
I don't know, because I don't feel at all charismatic or anything like that. I have a vague notion that I'm not cut for that kind of a situation. In fact, I resent the idea of giving orders or telling people what to do. But at the same time, I know that I am in a position where I somehow have to do something like that, at least now and then. But then I'm also a very private person, so I'm not capable of great social interaction. I think that's partly genetic.
Well, your community has been described as a recreation in modern terms of the Renaissance Atelier. And actually, wasn't it your joining the Atelier of Frank Lloyd Wright that brought you to the desert in the first place?
And that was a good lesson for me. But it wasn't a lesson, it was an experience. And I think I'm very glad to have had it, because I think it was a very positive experience. And when I look back at it, I see that my response were probably quite different from the response of young people now to what you might call the master. And perhaps that's because I was slower in my thinking, or I was less impatient or whatever, but it never occurred to me to discuss what was happening in Taliesin, which might not be very good, but that was my reaction. I was doing things there. I found the environment very interesting and exciting, and so I was going about doing what I was told to do. But those were the 40s and the 50s. They were not the 60s or the 70s. Now, I don't know what the balance is. I think both ways have something to offer. It is an element of arrogance in a contemporary scene, which I don't know if it's very good. At the same time, it is an element of inquiry and observation and questioning, which is very good. So I don't know what the balance is.
You say you feel an arrogance now in the contemporary scene?
In the young people, which is probably has been caused by teachers and professors telling the young people that, you know, look how beautiful you are, look how perfect you are, look what you can do if you were just freed from the coercion of society and so on, which I think it's fundamentally a lie, because beauty and resourcefulness and so on are very relative things, and hopefully growing up means to become a little better.
And if they understood what was being said to them, they would be humble.
Yeah.
And willing to learn.
Yeah, I think the humility should be ingrained into the learning process. And that goes for naturally for the master as much as it goes for the pupil. So what I would like to see is a little more balanced situation, maybe, where a little more humility might be interesting to see in the pupils. And the other thing that I keep rapping at is the element of self-pity.
You know? Self-pity?
Yes. Which is... yes, but what about me, you know, what I get out of it, and oh, this hurts, or this is demanding too much, or I'm ignored, or all those things, and there's always a grain of truth in those complaints, but then again, youth should be the time and the place and the circumstances where you can, you know, generosity, and it's such a great gift.
To have the energy of youth?
Yeah, the energy of youth, and feel less sorry about yourself.
Uh-huh.
And I think, again, that's part consequence of the affluent syndrome, and then this explosion in the 60s of what I feel it was an irresponsible reaction, not of the students, not of young people, but of the people responsible for them. The faculties, the professors, the teachers, and so on.
Picture of one of Palazzolari's extraordinary city designs, you're struck with the enormity of it and the complexity of it. He's a virtuoso designer. In fact, he first came to the attention of the design community in this country for his designs of ceramics and bridges and sculptural projects, and was acknowledged as master of all those forms, and he's incorporated that into his architectural and urban designs. And he's been creating, on paper at least, some projects for some very enormous buildings, some of them even a mile or more across. All of this generally gives rise to certain kinds of chronic criticisms. This will be a dehumanized anthill or a megastructure. And there is a certain tendency in contemporary real estate development to put together a really big package, something that will have something for everybody in it. But as I think you'll hear in this next section, Soleri's ideas are a little bit different. The thing which distinguishes an arcology from a mere megastructure, or huge building, is the development of the concepts that underlie it as a form of human organization. Would that be fair?
Yes, the degree of complexity which is assumed to be able to develop there gives the degree of liveliness and of fitness and coherence with environment and with other factors. And but as soon as you bring in the complexity parameter, you cannot avoid the physical parameter, which is the support of the structure of the grid, which makes for complexity. That's why the idea of miniaturization. Because we could imagine that there is something as complex as the brain, which is 50 times as large as the brain, but we can only conceive of, but we cannot probably demonstrate the feasibility of this thing, because as soon as the physical dimension changes, you lose the swiftness, you lose the immediacy, you lose the pertinence and the responsiveness. Because for very simple reasons of action and response and so on, if it takes that much time for a message to go from here to there, in that process something is going to change, so that when the response comes in, the response is for the past, is not for the present. And so the miniaturization parameter, it sounds like a materialistic element, but it's utterly tied with the notion of consciousness, of responsiveness, of immediacy, and of liveliness.
Do you see specialization within each of these cells? And I see Arcosanti as a cell, a series of units of perhaps scattered across the landscape, with lots of what's called green space, but in Arizona it's not necessarily green, green belt. There'll have to be communication between those units as well. I know community can be totally self-sufficient in this day and age. Yeah. I mean, there's always something it's dependent upon someone else to be doing, and there'll be a degree of specialization then in each area, say that in manufacture.
I think so. Otherwise, you're cloning, you know, things. And as we are repelled from the idea of cloning in creatures, organisms, living systems, I think we should repel the idea of cloning anything. Mm. I mean, so the cloning is really the condition of the origin. There is a particle, or there are a few particles which are self-identical. There are myriads of particles which are self-identical, and you start from there. So the more you move away from that condition, the more you're to, in many ways, define originality.
And that's certainly a very radical idea for American consciousness to try and absorb, since our whole psychological sense of security as we move across the landscape is developed by finding the same thing everywhere. Mm-hmm. And this has been pointed out over and over again, that the crummy hamburger that you eat in Phoenix is going to be identical to the one you find in...
You're feeling of
equal nausea.
Right. And the gas stations and all these other repetitive elements of the American landscape are an attempt to give people... What, a sense of location? Now you're saying that you're encouraging originality within the structures that you're creating, yes?
Not so much functional originality, but expression originality. In other words, the means might have a repetitive character to them, but the end is to come up with originality. And it's like saying, well, the bricks are always the same, but you can build a mansion, a humble house, a castle, and you can build a nice humble house or an ugly open house, and so on. So I'm not against repetitiveness or discipline or order or hierarchy, but I would be careful in believing that since this works nicely here, let's make a clone
somewhere else. Right, so this is another kind of appropriate response to condition, which you take into your design priorities when you approach something.
There is another element, which is an element of presence. We always say that we are building for a client or for a group of individuals or a society. The fact is that we are building for something which is not there as yet. If I'm going to build a house for a client and the house is going to take 2 years to be built, hopefully the original client is not what's going to be the final client. So we have to be very careful in believing.
That person will have transformed himself in the meantime?
Well, yeah. And part of that transformation might have been
the action of working in the house.
But aside of this factor, the fact is that this person has grown into something else. So there is an anticipation parameter in the process which we tend to ignore, and we say, well, everything is given. We're going to get together in this room and we're going to say whether we need this and this and this and this. And so we're going to behave according to what our needs are. Well, if we take that as strictly the guidelines, then evidently we're not doing anything that is future-oriented. We're doing something which is past-oriented. Mm-hmm. So we have to always inject this element of mystery, of knowability, and of sufferance in somehow. Which is part of the making the future.
So you have no fixed vision of what the way things should be, but it's an art.
Sufferance in somehow. Which is part of the making the future.
So you have no fixed vision of what the way things should be, but it's an ongoing vision that itself is transformed as it progresses.
You think that you can see modalities by which the future is becoming the present, and those modalities are very much suggested by history and more by evolution as a more comprehensive process. So you're trying to have some faith and to keep faith somehow to those modalities. At the same time, you have to be very careful in projection, which are too defined and too final. And if you look at any kind of science fictions things, the one thing that kills you is the mediocrity and the bore that you find in the environments which are designed or the customs which are developed, and that shows how difficult it is to anticipate.
So you're really trying to set up the conditions for creativity in the best sense.
Well, which again, it's very arrogant in many ways, but you're trying at least to keep things unstable enough so that might happen, and naturally also to have to define priorities that you feel are fairly important.
It sounds very Taoist. It seems so much.
I wish I knew more about Tao.
As though you're going down the list of the Tao Te Ching. It's so in the flow of being in that movement and being flexible and approaching problems and working around them and finding new solutions and always putting the pieces together as you go along.
Yes, at this point maybe we should introduce the opposite aspect, which is the continuity and permanency tradition, because without those elements, I think we don't have a ground to stand on.
How do you feel about permanency?
I feel strongly, and since I come from an environment which is not the American environment, and I have a certain ability to compare because I have been with both of them, I feel very deprived environmentally when I'm in this country. Deprived in a sense of not finding many things that mankind has been able to do in other places because of more time, basically, more time to develop a culture and a tradition and so on. So I would be very careful about the instant, whatever it is, plate, motorcycle, or civilization. And then again, you have to find a balance between the permanency of something and the necessity of transforming, of constant transformation.
Well, part of understanding the Taoist flow is to acknowledge the fact that whatever you do has repercussions mm-hmm. on all sides, that it mm-hmm. influences everything else. I think that's very much of what you're implying in
yeah.
the evolutionary process that you are
yeah, and it is an outflow, an outbreak from the past, which is somehow the only thing that we have to work with. So when you tend to make, let's say, some kind of a jump or a leap in many ways in terms of medias or instruments, then maybe you should be a little careful in trying to remind yourself that there's also the other aspect, which is not to leap, but to gently move into the future.
Mm-hmm. With a full consciousness of the mankind's achievements in the past.
Yeah.
Well,
and the struggle and the weight and the cost of those achievements.
One of the main things that has made the work of Paolo Soleri attractive to young people over the last 15 or 20 years has been the consistency and the wisdom of his moral position as someone who has embraced the simple life and economy of means in his work for many years and has consistently been able to support his creative work out of his teaching and bell-making activities. He's almost a model for this kind of thing. And it's his moral position that comes out in the talk that we had.
There is a constituency which doesn't exist yet, our unborn children's. And sooner or later we have to turn to this constituency and say, well, am I doing something which is at least neutral, if not damaging, for them? And then according to what the answer is, we should try to behave with it. So even if you come out with a structure which is going to be pervaded by opulence and materialities, but it responds in physical terms to a greater congruence and ecological equity, then what you pass to your children at least is a better instrument. The instrument is also a finality. It's not just a media, it's also a message. And this is very true in architectural environment. When you make a glass, it might be a little less true because a glass, if it's impermeable, if it's you can handle it, if it's not too dangerous, you can accept it. But that's a very specific function. When you move into the function of an environment, which is molding people, then the instrument cannot just be purely a device, has to be also a message, which brings in the aesthetic question.
Speaking of molding people, one of the things that interested me when you first arrived in the United States was your work in the desert in using the sand form and pouring concrete over them and then hollowing them out and creating living spaces that were almost imperceptible from the landscape. And that appealed to my hobbit-like nature. And I was quite startled when you started moving up out of the earth and creating these miniaturized, these condensed communities. And I had to question myself as to how I was mm-hmm. responding to it. But beyond my own particular view of that, how do you see the change taking place in Phoenix, for example, mm-hmm. you have just sprawling acres now of individual houses, each with their own swimming pool, each with a very wide road in front of it, each with a driveway and a carport, everything, you know, self-sufficient units. How do you, in that one sense that this belongs to me, they certainly aren't self-supportive, how do you see the consciousness changing and people willing to live tightly together and not want their own piece of land?
Well, the answer could be on a number of levels. One level would be the level of equity. The other one is the level of the ecosystem. Another one is the level of, maybe the fundamental level of what's the scope of life ultimately. On the level of equity, evidently, I can afford a swimming pool if I want it. But I can afford it because millions of other people have to pay for. Mm-hmm. And so that can go on up to a point, and then I have to look at my conscience and make a decision. And the day might come where we Westerners and we special Americans might have to make that decision. Because that decision is going to make for a life or a non-life for our children anyhow. Yeah, the level of congruence is that I don't think it makes sense, especially in a arid land. For instance, to have a swimming pool for one person or two persons. We have a swimming pool, but at least we pretend to say that there are 25 or 30 people at Kozanti that can use it. And actually, at Kozanti we'll have more than that. The point you were making at the beginning of looking at something that almost disappears in the landscape.
It seems to be a totally different philosophy there.
You can make a paragon, a parallel, which maybe is not fair, but in my illustrated point, you can say there is a meadow, which is a very nice thing, and then suddenly you have this gigantic tree sticking out of it, and I would be hard put to say that the meadow suffered and is legitimate and the tree is illegitimate. In fact, but that's only, it fits only to a point. But if you look at what you might call the organic, or again the ecologically fitting, then I think what fits is not the underground room, but it is above ground, three-dimensional creature. And that's because ultimately are a question of understanding, communication, learning, intensity, and all those things that cannot be developed in those isolated cells. You have to have a community of things. And since they're a community of physical things, besides being a community of mental things, you have to go back to how complexity is achieved. How can you have complexity without taking in the physical parameters? So this, which at first sight might look more organic, has to be sacrificed for the greater organicity of something.
It's not organic, it's romantic.
That's and nostalgic.
Right.
Which is not evil per se, but when you multiply it, you know, by the millions, which is what we are now, it becomes evil. No, it's... The society based on aristocracy could have extravaganzas because they were for few people. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the extravaganza for a few people becomes the norm, then you really got a problem. So while the automobile was a toy for, let's say, 1 or 2% of the population, it was one thing. When this toy became the instrument for survival for everyone, then the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's for everything else, I think, including swimming pools.
So we have to be careful of things that are designed solely for our own benefit.
Yeah,
we have to think in a broader...
Just because they are feasible and because they have some appeal. Evidently, there are many things that are appealing. But we have to watch out what they mean when they are... translated into the collectivity, into what the other fellow will do. Do I want this other fellow to do what I do? Well, then I have to watch out on the size of things and the clutter of things and the number of things and so on.
And by the other fellow, in many cases, you mean millions of other people doing the same
thing. That's the mm-hmm. And that brings in the necessity of frugality and can't escape it, I guess.
Of awareness. It's really what it comes down to, is really an involved
awareness and then performance. Because I can be aware of many things and then go my merry way.
Without acting upon them.
So that brings in the question of hypocrisy and...
The vision you offer, the experience that you offer to people is certainly very radically different from what America has traditionally meant to people. It's been an expansionist, traditionless situation. I mean, this country was at least in its present form, leaving aside the Native American culture, founded by European refugees, people who had it with traditional European cultural forms, were not able to pursue their lives in the ways that they wanted to. They founded a country which is based on a vision of kind of openness and expansion, and now, 250 years later, we're seeing that we're having to reconsider some of those very fundamental concepts, and it's just kind of this is a counter psychology almost that you're offering to people.
Well, I think there's a link between the belief that there's always a next frontier and possibly the inability to set limits to one's own greed and to one's own acquisition and to one's own feeling of the sacredness of ownership or whatever. And I think there has been an element of exploitation in this country, not because the people in this country were less good or whatever, but because it just happened in this country was such a cornucopia. I mean, it was harsh and difficult, but it was there, available, so there is always the possibility of exploiting this piece of ground, exhausting it, and then move 500 yards and repeat the same thing. So I am wondering sometimes if the vastness of this country wasn't one of the reasons for the character of our society. And at this point, we are beginning to understand that exploitation and accumulation and they are not really what we should be after.
I sense you can't look at yourself as a European anymore, and yet you're not really embracing the mythologies that have sustained America. Does that just make you a cosmic citizen?
Well, I don't know, but as far as citizenship, I always say that I would rather lose one than to acquire one, in a sense of, you know, eventually it won't make very much sense in terms of law that I am American, Swiss, or Indian, and so on. But for the moment, we stick with it, and maybe we have to accept those conditions. But again, since we are a privileged society, in a sense that we have so much, maybe we should try to begin to consider those aspects as, if not illegitimate, as very uninteresting.
The best article I've been able to find on the work of Paolo Soleri comes from a book by William Irwin Thompson called Passages About Earth. And in the chapter on individuals who have become institutions, he talks about Soleri. He says, if man is to find his place in anarchology, he must not move about in bourgeois upward mobility. He must not move about in the ecologically burdensome culture of wealth, with its cars, skidoos, and cabin cruisers. Like a man in the Middle Ages, he must know his place. And like a man in the Middle Ages, to know his place, he must live in a spiritual culture that makes up for all the toys that he has lost from the old bourgeois, materialistic, democratic days. The return of the Middle Ages is clear in Soleri's thought, says William Irwin Thompson. Apostate or not, Soleri's culture is Catholic, and his archaeologies are medieval cathedral towns. We didn't have very much time to pin Paolo down on those subjects, but before he escaped from us, we made one more attempt. Fella, you've been working for 30 or more years pursuing your vision for an integrated man, one that would take advantage of the best of the past traditions of humanity, and also at the same time not turn your back on the new possibilities that our technology and our present day scientific development offers us. And you've been really remarkably successful in articulating your ideas and turning them as much as possible into built form. I would like to know what you feel you may be able to achieve in the remainder of your life in order to express these ideas.
Well, one thing would be to be able to develop enough a prototype which might begin to function and demonstrate, and also be a place for improvements and changes and corrections and so on. The other is to develop the parallel model, which I tend to call it an eschatology at this point. Some kind of theological model. Because I think that at this point we really need something of that sort. And in a way I feel that some of the, at least many of the traditional theologies are not responding to that.
Can you tell us what that word means to you?
Eschatology?
Yes.
Well, eschatology, I think the Webster said something about the science or the inquiry into a final aim or finality. So I tend to believe that we, at this point, we can think in those terms. Not as a truth or as an existing thing, but as an hypothesis. And we know now that the truth is somehow based on fulfillment of hypotheses more than existing things or rules. So you make a model, then you try to fulfill it, to develop those conditions which are making the model a reality. To come up with a model which makes sense, or hopefully it transcends what exists now in better terms. So we have been inventing theologies for ages. I mean, in fact, man appeared when theology was invented, I guess.
The opportunity that we had to interview Paolo Soleri came about as a result of one of his infrequent visits to San Francisco, and he brought with him some of his assistants and students, One of them was a young man named Jack Blackwell. Jack was described as one of the real veterans of Arco Santi, since he had been there for 6 years, which made him one of the senior citizens. Right after Paolo made that last remark about man appearing when theology was invented, everyone broke up and said, "How do you know that, Paolo?" And Jack said, "Well, that's a story you really ought to get." Well, after the exhibition of the great model of Arco Santi was finished at the Cow Palace, as part of a big garden and ecology and so on and so forth type of show, Jack Blackwell was kind enough to come back into the studio and give us a very heartfelt, very open, kind of deep interview that showed me how much he has absorbed from Soleri and how truly... I'm talking with Jack Blackwell, who has been working with Paolo Soleri for a number of years now. Jack, maybe we could start by, if you could describe to us how you came to get involved with Paolo and where that has led you.
You have to start with childhood, I think. I grew up in a place that would be maybe the idyllic suburbia as opposed to the tract home reality. In its very first manifestations, what we call suburbia is really as much of a utopian venture as our colleges are today in a lot of ways. If we use the term utopian with a little bit of caution. I grew up in a community which the residents themselves got together and financed and built, and it was very open place socially. At the same time, it was bordering directly on nature. Those impressions still remain very strong, and they've always been my frame of reference in dealing with environments. The fact that I can move very freely around a local social environment with a lot of reinforcement. I think this came back in the Haight-Ashbury in a lot of ways. And the fact that virgin nature, so to speak,
was right there.
Is right there.
Yeah.
This remained in my mind as the tract homes began to cover this land and really turn it into suburbia as we know it. And the kind of mentality involved in that is much different. The exploitative economics vis-a-vis the kind of cooperative economics my parents and their friends were involved in. Now, this was not radical socialism or anything like that. It was very middle-class upbringing, and what you might call culturally barren if you're a city dweller. But the emotional level was there, and the living outdoors, contacting nature as a child, the ability of a child to move freely, I think is incredibly critical. My education is liberal arts, at a school in southwestern Ohio. Joined the Army in 1966 out of a desire for experience and to break out of the path towards a typical career in society, I guess, that college was heading me to. I was influenced by people like Henry Miller, Ayn Rand, people who counseled the doctrine of looking to yourself for knowledge. And this was all new to me and the environment of my upbringing. The Army, ironically enough, sent me to San Francisco eventually 1967, which was a very important time to be here, I believe. The whole experience of that era is impossible to summarize, and I'd only say that Altamont is maybe a focal event, because there we turned up all the demons under all the rocks and realized that the road towards better times was going to involve a lot more work than maybe a lot of us had anticipated. At that point, I came in contact with Soleri's ideas. I realized in my own mind that we had two roads basically possible for our generation to work within. One was, could be called mysticism. One could be called the emerging electronic hardwares. And of course, rock music was the beginning of an interface of those things. For the early bands, I think that was the case. Altamont told us it wasn't enough somehow. It wasn't enough in that thing to tame the animal in us. And therefore, we didn't really have the basis for a new civilization in that medium. But Soleri included the morphology, the physical arrangement of things in our environment as the overriding factor in how we can relate to one another. In the Haight-Ashbury, there was a synthesis of people on a level I think historically is unprecedented. And there's certainly been a lot of cynicism about it in the meantime, but I have to hang in there and say that I'll stick by that. It's something that I could never let go of. A person raised in a very small town, middle class environment, but with a certain amount of communal integrity, being exposed to synthesis that really represents what the city is all about as an institution, historically and in evolutionary terms. So, where do we go after the hate? Well, I think we go towards trying to establish more of a durational basis for that level of intensity. And we all took a lot of drugs, but it seems in the meantime people are taking a lot of drugs too, and it's not having the same effect. Well, the reason, maybe the premises, and the openness with which we all entered the situation, I believe that's typical of historical golden ages. I believe what we're after, what Soleri is after in his own way, is a society where standing on the street, there's an energy present which makes it impossible for you to be anything but positive and creative about the group you're involved in and about the environment you're in. In the 60s, we were developing that type of consciousness within an environment which was very unrelated to that consciousness in many ways. San Francisco was built in the early 20th century, most of it. With economic drives being predominant, with segregation of individuals on a, as we know, Victorian model. So we found in the 60s that within that morphology, Victorian society, we couldn't grow the consciousness that we had for a moment, for a long period of time, or at least not at great intensity, except through the incredible resources and energy of youth that just by its nature is not put off. But in the long run, we have to confront the physical morphology of our environments as perhaps the determining factor in how much synthesis is possible within a group of people. So Larry was doing this, and he was doing it well in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Well, this seemed like a natural... that has been a concern of architects and town planners since time immemorial, but...
Sure.
One of the things that came out of the late 60s was a sense of criticism of the existing society, people feeling that no matter how beautiful the environments were that we could create for ourselves. And you describe one of the idyllic suburban environments which our culture did manage to create. And I think a lot of that was rationalized around the rearing of children.
Mm-hmm,
a good place for my kid to grow up, not like what I had to do. People who came out of the basically European type cities, which were rebuilt on our shores in America by European residents, wanted to create something different, and they did. But then it was realized that underneath that were all the implicitly held assumptions and cultural patterns and values that were who people were. And I feel that a lot of energy has gone into changing that, figuring that the changes in the physical environment will naturally follow that.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. The changes will follow, but they will follow slowly because environments change much slower than our consciousness does.
Right.
So Arcosanti, in the work of redeveloping human settlements around more integrated models, is very logically and simply the expression of a consciousness which must already exist to a certain extent in order that those things could happen.
And it's trying to come out in a physical, an appropriate physical form.
Yes.
I see.
And also, it's use it or lose it, I guess, so...
For me, anyway,
if you've got that consciousness, well, great, you know, that's fine, but you won't even have it tomorrow unless it has some place to flow. That's valid. And that, there are entropic dead ends where many people's consciousness has had to flow because of the arrangement of things now. And I think we will lose it if we don't shortly devise more efficient uses for it, arcologies being the primary one that I have in my mind at this moment.
You yourself were not trained as an architect or a designer, and as I understand it, your role within the Arcosanti work is that of a teacher and somebody who is coordinating educational programs and sort of reinforcing or making clarifying the ideas which are the underpinning intellectual structure of the whole thing. Is that fair?
That's one role, definitely. And
what are some
along with that goes hand in hand the role of a builder. And that's, I'm trying to live what I see as the archaeologist in the making lifestyle, which is to integrate the activity of building, designing, conceiving of environments with the activity of what you might call spiritual advancement and growth. And as I said earlier, those two realities for me are the same thing in many ways. I came to Solaris without a formal architectural background, self-taught in what I would consider to be what Buckminster Fuller calls comprehensive design science, trying to integrate generalities from a number of perspectives. And I see that as the only way in which the present generation can really come to grips with its historical destiny. We've developed a refined degree of specialization to an extreme, which is certainly valid in evolutionary terms, but people like Solari are important because they've gone beyond those boundaries and tried to synthesize all knowledge again in a way. That's why you could almost call Solari and other contemporary people of that nature prophets. This is what I see the prophet does, performs for society historically. So as a self-taught person, my approach to Arcasanti is as a learning system in which there's really an instant testing of the validity of one's behavior. If it's not real good, the environment there is intense enough that it's going to blow you out. That sounds pretty off the wall. Well, I'll try to clarify that. But
you mean
my approach to work
there are real tests for your ideas,
and on many levels,
uh-huh.
Yeah, including just plain physical endurance. I began as a laborer, and then I got involved in building a large piece of public sculpture that Paulo designed for the city of Phoenix. It's a 1-ton Corten steel woman flying through space. It's about 20 feet by 8 feet, a welded steel plate. Through that involvement, I got interested in the metal trades and became the welder at Arcasanti. Well, there's no way that someone with all the metaphysical ballast that we all carry around can do welding without a real sense of using that as a metaphor, what holds the city together in a way, this molten steel, incredible heat, blinding light, all these things have more than a casual significance, and they certainly did for me. And there's a romantic adventure to the early days of Arcasanti, which is still there in some ways. So
you kind of downplay it now in the promotional brochures that you send out to people. You kind of stress the aspect that this is really going to be hard work, and you may have to do some things you don't want to do. And I seem to remember that the sense of adventure was much more present in the message that was being put out in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
Many people are still attracted to it, though, for that reason.
The thing is, the adventure has simply changed levels, as far as I'm concerned, and it's a much more complex adventure, and it's going to get much more complex because we're trying to integrate 4,500 minds more so than has ever been done historically, as far as I'm concerned. So
is 4,500 the ultimate population for Arcasanti, or is that the number of people?
That's the projected population.
The number of people that are working on the project now is in the hundreds, though, right?
At times it is above 100, but the number of people working there full-time is still about 25.
I see.
And those people change quite frequently. Well, how do you get from welding to running a... to trying to give people an experience of evolution? You get there by realizing that Arcasanti, as we worked on it in the early years, was moving awfully slowly. And although it's very easy to feel satisfaction about erecting a wall panel which takes you all day and takes a huge amount of involvement and energy. And people have done it themselves and feel the accomplishment. It's a very ego-gratifying thing. In the end, you have to confront the scale of the undertaking and the fact that it would never be completed at the rate we were moving. So what can be applied, what energy can be applied to give us the wherewithal for that quantum leap into building the town itself. I found that energy personally in Soleri's ideas, and after several years of immersion in that and in the thought of Teilhard de Chardin and in relating those to many, many other thinkers and many people who came to Arcosani and shared their energy and intellects and ideas, it seemed that Arcosani was no different from the human race in general in lots of ways. We're bogged down in cynicism, we're bogged down in an overflow of self-consciousness and reflection that is happening on a mass scale in the 20th century. We're vastly in need of confidence building at the very deepest level of our beings. That's the species as a whole. And the classical religions are not giving it to us anymore.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Arcosani is, as it presumes to be, an arrowhead of evolution. It really requires that we work out the motivation and clarity of aim there first, as presumptuous as that sounds. I've begun to find the source of that clarity and motivation and their interrelated commitment to do this work, which is a vast reorganization of not only people's heads, but the day-to-day way we live.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm
the feeling that what Soleri has gotten in absorbing the perspective of Teilhard de Chardin, the whole idea of a cosmic evolution leading through human beings to another state somewhere in the future, the trends that we extrapolate from that, and the significance of the position of men today in that process. I think Soleri has taken a step beyond any classical religion. In saying that there is no pre-existing God that's created this universe, that the universe began not by chance, by probability, by the simple logic that to have something is more probable than to have nothing. And that by laws of great numbers, the first syntheses in the universe came into being. Gradually, as this process of synthesis unfolds, it leads us through the rise of life in planetary systems. It leads us to the rise of thought, and it leads us to the present. As far as I'm aware, this whole idea, the evolution of thought towards a higher level, has been expressed in every occult system of self-enlightenment. But Soleri is expressing it on the level of planetary man. Not how do you, as an individual, control and create the universe, but
as a social being.
That you as an individual are a seamless web with other individuals in the world, in the world of the flesh and thought creating itself. For Soleri, that is God at this point in our universe. There is nothing beyond us, you and I, leading us, protecting us, taking care of us after we're dead, or helping us to get through the next day, or helping us to create, to transform the material world. Soleri expresses this thought that man's intelligence is not in the process of discovering the truth, but he's in the process of creating it. And such revelations as we have through classical religions represent our ability to imagine the future. And in fact, classical religion has needed up to this point, because in a way our consciousness is that of an infant, to imagine a past perfection that existed. For Soleri, this proposition is reversed. The classical religions are valid only in so much as these images of grace, of the Garden of Eden, and so forth, were like metaphysical architecture. They were the way in which the mind must take hold of itself and give itself direction on a societal, at a societal level, and an individual level too. But these were only simulations, that nothing such as that existed, except in the imagination of us. And that, in fact, that perfection, that total enlightenment, only exists as a possibility. It exists as a possibility, and at this point in history, we're at a time when the classical religions are actually holding us back. That to imagine that someone, something, some other force is going to bail us out, is a negative influence on evolution, because at this point man must take total responsibility for life. There's no other alternative. And any religion which teaches that that responsibility lies elsewhere, for Soleri anyway, and I've come to agree, lets us off the hook to the extent that our total creative power is not present in our actions. At this point, man must take total responsibility for life. There's no other alternative. And any religion which teaches that that responsibility lies elsewhere, for Soleri anyway, and I've come to agree, lets us off the hook to the extent that our total creative power is not present in our actions. And it even can lead to the stopping of the growth of consciousness. Teilhard de Chardin has expressed the idea that reflection must ultimately be able to see a way ahead of itself that's worth pursuing a higher destiny, or it will abort itself. The structure of consciousness is such that it cannot exist. It will commit mental suicide, as it were. Consciousness introduces a choice into life. It introduces the power of life to take account of itself and determine whether it should continue or whether it should stop. Soleri, I think, represents a breakthrough. He's going to say that, yes, all the classical religions are valid, but what we need now is a religion, and he uses the term, so I'm not bastardizing it, a religion which can include and go beyond all those traditions, a planetary religion, and it's the religion of God-making. It's the religion that we believe that through taking total responsibility for what has made us, what we stand for, that is, all of life, all 15 billion years that we know about, scientifically anyway, rests in each one of us. And nowhere else. We are life at this point. And we are life taking an evolutionary dead end, scattering into entropy, or consolidating and intensifying. There's no middle ground between those two.
This consolidation and intensification in its physical manifestation takes the form of the city designs, the arcologies,
that's correct,
intense, densely organized cities.
Mm-hmm.
And in the personality, in the individual, the consolidation and intensification, how does that manifest?
I think it comes in terms of an internal revolution which shakes you to your roots, in the same way that perhaps drugs have shaken some of us. That's the only general metaphor I can come up with. It comes in the coming of age of mankind, from merely experimenting, from merely discovering how the world works, grasping more and more power over its workings through our understanding of nature. It evolves to the state of an adult man, an adult humanity, which maybe has a grain of seriousness there that it didn't have before, in that, and I'm not describing a state that I have reached or Soleri has reached, although you touch upon it sometimes, a sense of unity with the universe that's not pastoral. It's the sense of unity with the universe that imbues our actions with great integrity. But there, I'd clarify that and say what this internal revolution represents is more anguish for us. It's not a way out of our anguish. It's in a way plunging deeper into it, because in Soleri's scheme of things, there is no total enlightenment possible until actually evolution completes itself, until this universe, which began 15 billion years ago, at some point in the future reaches its, what Teilhard calls, its spiritual pole, its complete, utter transformation from matter, from pure matter into pure spirit. Today's man, today's person, is in an absolutely unprecedented and critical position along the path of this universe, at least the section of it that we know about. The planet Earth is the only place where reflection exists, where human consciousness exists. It really puts us on the hot seat. Soleri's philosophy can barely be accepted today, but it could not have been accepted by, for instance, Nietzsche. One person, Soleri, refers to as an influencing factor, may have achieved this insight on a personal level. It blew his mind. Perhaps it'll blow a lot of our minds before we come to grips with it. I think it will blow our minds if we don't come to grips with it collectively, that the responsibility that impinges on man at this point can't be faced by any individual alone. Even Soleri, or people like him, it's by the structure of evolution, it must be a collective experience. So all our pursuit of individual enlightenment is valuable as the development of our organism, our thinking organism. And I think there's no getting around that. In fact, we have to take the lonely monk's position, the hermit's position, the seeker of one's own soul position for a time. We must come back from that into
collective action.
Right. Which, I don't know if we're really facing up to that right now. At least we're not at Arcasani totally facing up to it. And I think many communities get around it by appointing someone as the voice of God and trusting that voice, which may be valid to some extent. But in Soleri's theory and philosophy, each one of us stands in that position. It can't be shoved off. It can be shoved off to those who are older and more experienced, but ultimately each individual has to come to terms with the same responsibility for his own existence that people like Teilhard and Soleri have already done to some extent. Yet coming to grips with it collectively is the thing that hasn't been done yet. It hasn't been done by classical religion as I see it, only in a very ritualized way. We're not talking about rituals here. The experience that I'm trying to create in the people in the workshops is very far from stylized watered down experience of what life represents. I think our position now is that we can really get, well, Teilhard expressed it as being not only at a kind of crossroads where not only our own ideas but things themselves radiate from. That's the position of us today. Opening ourselves to it is the problem that we have to help each other. I don't think we can do it alone, or should either. If Soleri's ideas represent a good summary of where we're at, of where human consciousness is at on this earth, that is that man is just now peeking his head above childhood and taking account of the fact that we're the gods such as God exists at all. Not a perfect God by any means. And certainly, it's an anguishing position, as I've said. This is the way in which the energies can be generated to move life on to another level.
Is that similar to the statement that was made in the late 60s in the preface to the Whole Earth Catalog?
Sure.
That we are as God, so we might as well get good at it.
We might as well get good at it, except that even seeing that we are as God is so heavy that it's going to take a generation or so
for that to sink in.
Sure.
I don't know, do you think people are ready to accept the responsibility for their evolutionary destiny?
I think we have no choice whatsoever. None at all. We'll do that or we'll destroy ourselves. And the evidence is growing that that is exactly what we're doing. The only certainty that I can endorse at this point is that life represents the rise of complexity through the means of gathering things into more efficiently performing bundles. Human city is an infant example of this at present. During the time that present cities, with which all of us are familiar, San Francisco in particular, came into being, and possibly through the intensified intellectual, spiritual possibilities of those situations, we've evolved two new technologies side by side. One, the ability to transform matter and to control it in much more effective and broad ways, represented by perhaps going to the moon. It's a good example. To do anything we want, virtually anything we want, with electronic circuitry, structural technology. At the same time, during this period of human history, we've come into a scientific understanding of our origins on a much wider scale than we had before. So that men like Apollo and Teilhard, taking advantage of this wider intellectual scope, the compression of human beings, and the intensified sphere of thought that within which great minds operate today, as opposed to earlier eras, it was possible to achieve a synthesis between the physical and the spiritual evolution of life. That gives us the wisdom to apply these technologies toward the direction which life has always been seeking, that is, to transform itself from matter into spirit by means of the route of complexity. This has been done at any time in human history, I believe, when culture has been at its height, when the things that we regard as great have been achieved. But to do so self-consciously and deliberately is a new idea, at least on a scale of society. That is why, to me, Arcosanti represents a bud, an incipient bud of something incredibly new and portentous for the human race. It's at Arcosanti that people, myself, people like you, are taking into their hands these two phenomena, an understanding of how life has come to be what it is, what it's striving for, the rise of the spirit in this universe, and our intellectual powers to understand and manipulate matter deliberately, which in the past has been done mainly as a means of survival. Arcosanti represents a reversal of priorities in terms of design, and I think we also represent a reversal of priorities in terms of design. Human beings have changed the orientation of life from one in which chance, competition for space, the survival of the fittest in physical terms, have determined the design of organisms, into a new level in which the outcome of those chances and those design changes, that is, human thought has taken hold of life locally and begun to transform it. So, the city, as it presently exists, is a machine created for the economic reasons of survival at its deepest level. To be human, to be analogous to what we are in nature, that is, an organism in which the spirit is a predominating factor. The city must be reorganized along the priorities of achieving a human ecology, what Soleri refers to as a human ecology. That is, an environment in which thought, the interaction of minds and ideas, is facilitated as well as and effectively by the physical infrastructure in which we all must operate. In that, Arcosanti is unique, and in that lies our salvation, in the sense that we must keep that priority if we're to avoid sinking into having our ecologies become what many people fear, the ultimate expression of statism, of centralized control, of all the things incipient in industrial culture as it exists now, without a head, without a soul, in many ways, blindly grasping at more and more power. If human evolution has reached a state in which we can consciously take control of it, then there's not only hope for the earth, but there's the hope of something more than has ever existed on the earth, and that is what Arcasanti represents to me, the beginning of that. We are privileged, all of us, to be at an incredibly potent stage in the movement of life in the world. There will only be one time in the history of this planet when life deliberately takes hold of itself on the scale of collected human minds and builds more complexity, more connection, more possibility for love is the best way I could describe it, into itself. One first time. I think Arcasanti is that time, and therefore the incredible amount of hassles that go into building it are really meaningless when you consider it in those terms.
Looking ahead, if you could, to that thing which is in your mind that is being created here, what do you feel that would be like?
I don't think we have anything to refer to historically that could convey the power of it, except
I'm asking
if you're
for
in love. If you're in love with someone, this sounds kind of weird. That's the way it seems to me. We could have a society in which more people would be in love. That's what I'm looking for. But the beauty of Arcasanti is also the danger. There, we don't know what'll be there. We don't know. And there's no way to even begin to predict. It's a change, for me, the change that we're embarked on is a change of the magnitude of reflection coming into existence 3 million years ago. That's what the integration of many minds really integrating, not just an occasional glimpse of connection, but an organic connection between us, which is only incipient and very, very fragile and unrealized at this point. Any time that we've experienced that, though, on an individual level between two people, that's a glimpse of what we're after on a societal level.
Do you expect that will be achieved in your lifetime?
I expect that we'll have taken the first step in that direction. And I'm convinced that it will be achieved, whether it's in my lifetime or not. But I'm glad and scared to death that that we're the generation that is going to embark on that for the first time. This is something totally new in a lot of ways. And that's where we're at as a generation too, though. I mean, all of us who, for whatever reason, we're drawn into any experimentation at all. They know in their hearts that being alive, that's what being alive is for. It's just that chance, that risk, the challenge above all that we have to keep engaging ourselves with. And the challenge on this earth right now, as crazy as it might sound, is the construction of that thing out there on that mesa in central Arizona. You can be fully alive by only by engaging yourself in the and the greatest challenge open to our particular evolutionary moment. And that's something that's not for everybody. It might not even be for me, ultimately, but it's there, it's available, and if we don't get the best minds involved in it, it may be a chance that doesn't come again.
Well, you've been involved with this work for the last 5 years of your life. The work at Arcasani continues. The energies of Paolo Soleri and the people that he has been able to bring around him seems to continue year after year, growing and reaching into the public imagination. And all I can say is I really wish you all the fruits of the intense work that you're doing, both out there on that mesa in central Arizona and on yourselves in the process of transformation.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Stephen Hill and Jack Blackwell, Director of Educational Programs at Arcasanti, Builder, Dreamer, walking together toward the vision of a more perfect future. If you'd like information about Arcasanti, the workshop programs, which happen every 6 weeks, which entail construction work, discussions with Paolo Soleri, 4-day seminars, and living on the site, or events that happen on the equinoxes and solstices, or the arts festival, which happens in the fall, you can write to the Cosanti Foundation. That's COSANTI Foundation, 6433 Doubletree Road, Scottsdale, Arizona, 85253. So many topics tonight. Such promise for a new vision, a bright future. All brought to you by New Dimensions. We want to thank you for listening, for being with us, for sharing the faith in the future. This is KQED FM, San Francisco. Good night.